How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvers and Dave Meltzer here, Wrestling Observer Radio. It is November 30, 2016, figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. Very happy today to be joined by Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins, professional wrestling. Obviously, cannot say TNA Impact Wrestling because that's not the case. Billy, how are you doing today?
I'm very good, thank you.
Well, let's start here at the beginning. I presume that everything is settled between you and TNA and that you are going to continue on in the wrestling business. Is that right?
That's generally true.
Generally true. Let's start at the beginning here. You have been involved in wrestling for a while before you got involved with TNA. You had a promotion of your own that you ran for a while or were involved in, Resistance Pro, and eventually got involved with TNA. Tell everybody a little bit about how you decided to get involved in pro wrestling.
You know, I have to kind of blame PJ Polacco, just incredible to everybody. He's probably the first person that I knew behind the scenes that sort of smartening me up to the business and got me very intrigued, turned me on to the Wrestling Observer and said, you need to start reading this stuff if you really want to know how the business works. So it kind of started a fascination with the behind the scenes, the inner workings of the promotions, the politics, the personalities involved, which I found fascinating. And then, of course, when I would meet people, go to shows and stuff, I would ask questions and try to understand booking philosophies, you know, whether it was Paul Heyman or whoever. And I started to really love the business. I thought there was something sort of fascinating about it, and it kind of connected with my love of the business as a fan. You know, it was like the thing I saw and what I liked about it dovetailed into what I liked to the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Now, what year was this that you first got introduced to all of this and started asking questions? How long was it before you decided that you were going to start your own promotion?
Well, I'd actually talked to Lou DeAngeli, who most people would know as Sign Guy Dudley or Paulie Dangerously from ECW. We had talked about starting a promotion as early as 2001, let's say somewhat out of the ashes of ECW. I was flush with cash at that time, but I didn't know much about the business, and it just didn't work out, and then he went in a different direction with his wife. And so it just kind of laid there as an idea. I was always sensitive to the idea, which of course dovetails into the story of what I just went through, about people sort of seeing me as an easy touch for money. So that's why I think in terms of independent wrestling, that felt comfortable at first, because it was like, you know, the well only went so deep as far as what you were going to spend.
Now, going back, there was a story, and in the, I don't know what year it was, but it was towards the end of ECW, where there was a story that you know, you were approached to buy or to fund it or to buy a percentage of the company, and you turned it down at the time. How accurate is that, and what were kind of the details, and what was your thought process as far as, you know, ECW was going down at the time, but it did have a pretty wild product, and there's a lot of pluses and minuses of ECW in that time frame, but what was kind of like going through your mind and the story of that?
Well, it was pretty simple. Lou DeAngeli had reached out to me and said, Paul would like to meet with you, and we met at some Manhattan diner somewhere and had a very nice conversation, and then, you know, I felt the Paul Heyman promo coming on. If you've ever been Paul Heyman promoed, he's the best.
I think I spent my life on that one.
Fantastic. And Paul basically said in that beautiful sonorous voice of his, "How would you like to own a piece of ECW?" And he asked me for $1 million, and I said, "What do I get for $1 million?" And he said 10%, and I laughed and said, "Paul, I know I can do math. ECW's not worth $10 million." So it never really got much beyond that. And the thing that Paul didn't know that I didn't. No, because I was friends with a lot of the guys who were working, that he owed tremendous amounts of money to different talents. So I knew even if I gave him $1 million, he was just going to turn around and hand it to RVD and whoever else he owed money to at that time. In many cases, the best of my recollection, a lot of those guys never even got paid what they were due. So, but I think it bears noting that at that point, I had very little connection to the business outside of being a fan and sort of showing up at shows and just kind of hanging out. I didn't know much about the business. I didn't really understand the dynamics like I feel I do now. So
how did the pieces fall into place for you where you felt now is the time that I'm going to launch this thing?
Are you talking about Resistance Pro?
Yeah.
It was a situation where the brothers who still run the promotion had approached me through some sort of other thing that they were involved in and said, what do you think about starting a promotion? And it's just, it was one of those things that just struck me right on that right day. And we got involved and, you know, I got it to the point where we had signed a reality show deal with AMC. So there was some upside to it as far as what I was after and what I was trying to do. I saw the reality show model at that time as a way to kind of create a different interest in people's connection to professional wrestling vis-a-vis kind of letting people behind the scenes, because to this point, no one's ever really done it. You know, a true, honest reflection of what goes on behind scenes, the scenes at a professional wrestling company or even just an independent company. And when that all kind of fell apart, that ended, and I just walked away and thought, okay, that was my, you know, that was my big foray into professional wrestling, and I spent 6 months thinking I would never go back other than sort of observationally or maybe even, you know, occasionally if somebody wanted me to do something. But I after that experience ended, and it ended not too well, I thought, okay, I'm done with this. And it that's how it lay until I got on the phone one day with Dixie Carter, who I knew previously, and she threw out the idea that I would come into work for TNA on a creative level. And that's what started this journey that we're on now. Or so, it has ended now, depending how you look at it.
Sure. So when you were doing Resistance Pro, and it all ended, and as you noted, it wasn't exactly a nice ending. I mean, were you satisfied with what you'd done in wrestling? I mean, obviously, whatever happened, you decided, okay, that's it for me. But was there a sense of satisfaction that you had done it despite how it ended?
No, not at all, because my interest in wrestling is predominantly creative. For lack of a better way to put it, I believe I have a set of philosophies that I've formed over time. Some of which have been informed by, you know, Dave, who's on the line here, his philosophy on, you know, what draws, what works, what traditionally and historically works. I mean, I read my Observer for years, you know, sort of noting what had and hadn't worked over time, and I watched some of those promotions, so I had at least a historical basis on what I wanted to do. There are some old school things that are not present in the current scene that I still think would work in a modern context. So it was really creatively, and that was sort of partly what enticed me to work for TNA, was the idea that could I apply those philosophical beliefs to a professional wrestling company on a big level, and could they work? And thankfully, at least some of the philosophies I had did work and were successful. So it was a good instinct, and I would akin that to the same instinct that I used to be successful at music. It's a certain feeling you have about maybe there's a niche in the market that maybe nobody's exploiting, and if you do it a certain way, maybe you can sort of do something new there. And I'm the type of artist mind that I want to do something new. I'm not interested in repeating success. I always believe the best success is creating something new.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, because the one thing that I would say in the last 6 months, certainly the most talked about thing from a creative standpoint in TNA has been the Matt Hardy character and the Hardys and everything like that. And I know you were involved in that in some form. What, you know, kind of give us kind of the genesis of how that came, and you know, what kind of things were you looking for, and are you kind of disappointed that it's still going on and now you're kind of outside of it, so to speak?
Sure, there's a lot of questions there. I'll try to tackle them. To begin with, I pushed from day one in creative and behind the scenes, and of course using my personal relationship with Dixie Carter to try to get them to open up what they were doing in the booking and the way they approached their television. To me, it was a flatline television product that was growing slowly but not at the rate that you would need to sustain itself. And so I was pushing for what I would call a somewhat more avant-garde or out-of-the-box approach. And that was born out of, you know, hundreds of conversations with talent, Jeremy Borash being one of those people, as far as somebody that worked, you know, for TNA behind the scenes for, you know, since the beginning, who understood the politics there, and sort of trying to figure out how I could use the position I was in, which wasn't that great. I mean, I was on the booking committee, but I didn't have a lot of power at that point. How I could sort of use what I knew and what I felt to try to open the door. And I've seen at times, and I don't pay a ton of attention to what's written about me in regards to wrestling, but I see times where people think I've tried to take credit for the final deletion or the Hardy characters. That's not at all my own perspective. My perspective is I helped crack the door open that allowed that thing to come through. Then once it came through and I saw the result, then I was all over it. And I really had to fight, particularly Dixie Carter, who was horrified by a lot of the negativity of the first Hardy angle, which was, you know, if you remember, it was the involved the baby, and, you know, there wasn't much to it. I think it was pretty much only like a 5 or 7 minute thing that Jeremy and Matt and Jeff and Rebbe had done at Matt's place. And once I saw the heat from that and the off the street reaction, then that's where I really did step into the space, and I really forced it through into a bigger program.
Was that the angle where she threw the fake baby?
Yeah. I mean, if you remember, it's hard sometimes because it has become this strangely iconic thing now. And one of the top stories, and certainly, you know, Matt's rebirth in particular as a character, I think is one of the top stories of the year. I think if you go back to the reaction after that episode first aired, a lot of people were very condemnatory of it. They said, this isn't wrestling, and what the fuck is this? Excuse my French. You know, this isn't wrestling, you know, and I'm like, no, this is finally we have a ray of light here of something different that I would argue is proprietary to TNA as a company. And I think the fact that WWE imitated you know, the deletion stuff so quickly after it took root, I think showed you that we were on to something.
I want you to talk a little bit here about the baby thing, because, I mean, it was campy, and it was so obvious that she was throwing a fake baby, but I did hear that, I mean, people were freaking out about this. And I thought, I mean, it's so obvious what's going on here. How could you possibly be upset about this wacky portion? I mean, it was like a moment of a 10-minute deal. I don't know. I thought it was very much overblown, but apparently it was a much bigger deal than a lot of people know. Is that right?
I don't know. I mean, what's funny to me is, I think, this goes back to personal philosophy, I think wrestling at this point, it really needs to subscribe to the rules of television, which is you have characters, and those characters, depending on the universe they inhabit, can do certain things. So if you go see a Marvel movie, it makes sense that so-and-so can fly through the air, like I just saw Doctor Strange. He puts on the robe, he can fly through the air. So the minute we started booking Matt and Jeff and Rebbe and Senior Benjamin like their own characters living in their own universe, or to Matt's words, his own broken universe, we saw where people were attracted to those characters. They were willing to go along for the ride. The fact that one thing was campy or one thing was controversial, that's just television.
Yeah, and as long as it's consistent, it shouldn't be a problem.
That's my argument. I mean, I think we're long overdue for a sort of cultural change in the world of professional wrestling. I mean, it's very, very behind other art forms at this point, as far as entertainment, television, and look at the groundbreaking television that's been created in the last 5 years because of the changes in the way people are viewing their consuming their content. I mean, totally different approaches to television, how people are marketing. I mean, wrestling is way, way behind that curve. It wasn't like I was sitting there as somebody who considers himself a fine artist. I mean, it wasn't like I was sitting there thinking we're painting Rembrandts. I just thought we were just cracking open into something new. And the minute we got some light and it got some traction, well, then you saw where the talent came forward and started creating things that, you know, some were good, some were great, some were good, some were not so great. But I mean, at least we were onto something different. And that's why I said it was somewhat proprietary. It was like, this was something we could claim as our own. Whether you liked it or you didn't, you could say, well, that's what differentiates us from the WWE product.
Now, from a business standpoint, obviously TNA has been struggling a lot in the last year. And, you know, given that you funded it at certain points and everything, I mean, when they came to you and said, or you knew the situation and was just like, you know, we need money for this taping. If we don't do this taping, who knows what'll happen? Contracts will be voided and stuff. And you did this for a couple of tapings and everything. Kind of, what was your long term was that you wanted more of a control of the company, obviously. And
well, it's almost easier. I'm not trying to run your show here, but I mean, it's a little easier to explain as it sort of developed over time. It doesn't sort of compress into one approach, if that makes any sense.
Well, let's start at the beginning then. So you mentioned having a conversation with Dixie, and I presume, I mean, did you follow TNA from the very beginning, and what were your thoughts on it over the years leading to that conversation?
Well, I used to even go back when they ran the Nashville Fairgrounds. I'd go down to shows every once in a while and hang out, and so you know, and had even helped at some point help Jeff have access to WGN television way, way back. So there was sort of unofficial contact between me and the company. At different times, I pitched the company on creative ideas I had. Every time I was shut down. I mean, no one would even give me the time of day. So my general thought was, like a lot of fans, it felt like the little engine that was never going to get there. Every time they seemed to sort of get something good going, they'd shoot themselves in the foot. And I even remember going to see when Hogan and Bischoff were there, seeing some stuff. I went to a show and talked to some people there, and I remember some of the booking, and I was looking and I was thinking, God, it's like they just can't get out of their own way, you know? So my general impression was, I would say, leaning negative, even though I had personal connections with the people, and I certainly wanted the company to do well because I liked the business. Overall, I didn't think much of the company, so I think that sort of fed into why, when I got the call to be part of the creative side, I thought, well, okay, having been in professional wrestling for a while and having sort of somewhat of a knowledge base that I've built up in my own mind, I thought I could help the company, and I think over time I was able to prove that I could help the company. So that's where that kind of led into everything else that involved money and everything else.
So she called you in 2015, and what did she say?
She said very sweetly and nicely, you know, we would love to have you come on and be part of the booking committee. And I was like, you know, it was like I kept waiting for the asterisk, you know, and there was no asterisk. It was like, you will be part of the booking committee. So I went down, I had a meeting, and, you know, they started asking me. They sent me every episode, I think the all the Destination episode, America episode. So I watched, I don't know, 26 weeks worth of programming to kind of get back up to speed, because I hadn't really been watching as of late. I had a similar opinion to what a lot of people had, which is there was nothing to see there. I was sort of surprised that I did see some progress. I was surprised by some of the people on the roster that were better than maybe I thought they were. So I saw enough growth there that I thought, okay, I can do something with. So when I went and had a meeting with them in Nashville and they kind of picked my brain what I would do, I laid out very similar ideas to what I eventually ended up sort of trying to put in place and push for behind the scenes. So I was consistent in that, and they seemed receptive to it. Of course, I found out later that that's not why they had me down there, that I was being worked for some other reason. So that's a whole nother story. I don't know if you want to get into that, but...
With the benefit of hindsight, what was the reason then that they brought you in?
It was later admitted to me by someone in the company, and Dixie later confirmed this to me, that I really wasn't brought in to be on the creative staff. I was really brought in to be a chip that they could play to get another network deal, because they were already worried they were going to lose their Destination America deal.
So they thought that your contacts in television and just that maybe you could help, and I mean, one thing that I remember at that time was they were always pushing your name in the sense that, well, Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins, it's kind of a somewhat, you know, celebrity name. That involvement kind of, you know, I would say giving the company a little bit more prestige. So you think that that was kind of it, that like, hey, Billy Corgan's involved, you know, we're taking a step upward. We've got, you know, a well-known celebrity, and he's kind of endorsing it, and he's even part of our creative team.
Let's look at it like, let's not even cast any sort of nefarious ideas, right? They invite me into the company. They don't have to give up much to get me as far as money. They don't have to give up much in the way of power or control. And they get a really good return for what they're investing. And it is worth noting that at one point I went unpaid for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically getting a guy who you can use his name, you can sort of throw it around as a possibility. And they did throw it around, because my contacts in the entertainment business would call up and say, is this legit, and da-da-da-da-da. So they basically got me on the cheap and or for free, depending on how you look at it. So maybe they looked at it as just a good business play. Of course, I would point out that I was brought in basically on a fraud to begin with. And so that, I think, sort of sets up, you know, it's like the soil that you plant something in. I didn't realize that I was entering a situation which wasn't what I was being told. If I'd been told that from the beginning, I still would have gone there. I still would have been involved. But I think the idea was, you know, we can use this guy for X, Y, and Z and let him think something else.
Well, I don't want to look at nefarious plots and such, but in hindsight, after the way everything went down, I mean, aside from just using your name, do you think when she first made that phone call, in the back of her mind, she was thinking, I'm not going to ask him for money right now? But this guy's got money.
This guy's got money, and we can put him on television, and you know that story. You put someone on television, and the seduction of television being a TV character type of a thing, yeah.
I don't know. All I can tell you is that I had innumerable conversations with her where she talked about getting other people's money. So I can only guess that I was talked about in the same way. That in essence, it's like, you know, as we have often done in our own lives when we, you know, we don't have $50 to pay the rent, we think, can we call Phil, Lou, or Joe, you know? And I think in her mind, she had a running Rolodex of people that she could call and lean on under any given circumstances to see if, quote-unquote, they wanted to own a wrestling company.
Now, one thing about television wrestling today, obviously, and TNA was in this position with Destination America, and they did get another deal and everything, is when you're, and at this point, you're involved with TNA when this is all going down.
Right.
I mean, how, and your name is being thrown out as part of their credibility, how difficult and what are the problems as far as people being able to get television wrestling deals in 2016 and 2017? Because obviously, you know, we know with Jeff Jarrett trying to start up and never getting that deal. And there's, you know, a lot of people would love to start up a company. And there's an incredible amount of talent out there that's underutilized that could really shine with the right television deal. What's kind of like your impression of how television is viewing this and why this is so difficult to make that deal?
You're talking about the industry overall.
The television industry and trying to, you know, just trying to get that company and get a company that can be somewhat sure. Competitive on, you know, on a national basis and be an alternative to WWE, so to speak.
Well, I think you need look no further than what Vince did when he started the WWE Network. I mean, he decided years ago, you know, quite brilliantly and presciently that he needed to get into his own television business.
Yeah.
And I think that tells you everything that you need to know. Now, that said, even though wrestling stock as it pertains to television is quickly diminishing, the fact that broadcasters overall are losing leverage in the marketplace against, say, digital broadcasting or YouTube or whatever, you know, Hulu or whatever, I think that gives new opportunities, whether it be a startup or even a Ring of Honor or something, that there will be opportunities there in that transitional space for people to step in and still run wrestling on traditional television.
So when she first brought you into the company, did you get your ideas through?
Sort of. It was sort of like win one, lose two. First of all, she had very little contact with what went on creatively. I was sort of surprised by that. I guess I put my own self, if it was me, I would have been more hands-on with, you know, if something didn't work or the ratings didn't come in, I feel like I would have been more all over it. I saw very little contact from her as far as what the company was doing internally. So once you figured that out, then you were basically dealing with who you were dealing with. And what I found was...
Was that mostly John Gaborik?
Well, John was running creative at that time. You know, it was trying to win him over with ideas, and his perspective on wrestling tends to be more traditional and or WWE. So really it was winning favor over time with the ideas I had that did work, building relationships with talent. So when I was given an opportunity, whether it was to produce or push something through on my own, I started kind of hitting, you know, doubles and triples and eventually home runs. So I gained credibility kind of, you know, the old-fashioned way, which was just kind of brick by brick.
Now, when did you first start to determine that maybe you weren't getting the whole story about a lot of different things, mostly financially?
Well, that gets into the complications of why I filed a lawsuit. So it's hard to... You know, it's like a big accordion. I don't know how deep you want to go into that. And there's certain things I can't talk about, but I'm more than willing to try to go through it. But it's not a simple thing I can answer.
Well, maybe let's start with when was the first time that she approached you about wanting to borrow money, and what was your initial thought when she asked you this?
Well, I think there were some things thrown out early in 2016 that I didn't even take seriously because they really were kind of crappy loan type of scenarios. like, I'll give you this for this and this. And I kept saying I'm not interested in being a lender, which, of course, the great irony is that's how I was eventually classified in court as a predatory lender. I had no interest in being a lender, and I said that repeatedly. So it didn't really take root until the first time I did put in money, which I guess was June, somewhere around there, because I think there was a pay-per-view coming up. But there was something kind of serious, and it was definitely like, if I didn't put in money, the company was going to be shut down.
Now, there were rumors that there was some sort of deal with Auralux or Airlux or something, where if they didn't do this, Airlux was going to take over. I mean, were you approached with these doomsday scenarios, and that's why you decided to make the loan?
I was, but that wasn't really, that wasn't part of my thinking. My thinking was that, for lack of a better way to put it, I saw a great roster. I saw some artistic and creative ideas starting to take root, not only with the company but also with the public. And I because I was being given a picture that wasn't necessarily true, the distance across that bridge didn't seem that far.
So when this is all going down, the financial situation that they were purporting to you was very different than it actually really was. I think that's kind of when I sensed from the lawsuit, in the sense that, I mean, you knew things weren't good, obviously, because the company was, you know, I mean, you had to save them from essentially shutting down a couple times.
Three times,
but,
to be
three
fair.
Times. And but you didn't realize exactly how bad it really was. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah, I contended in court, and may once again contend in court someday, because, and we can talk about that. I was not given accurate reads on what was going on internally. So as much as I knew, there was stuff being obscured from me, and I would argue willfully.
Yeah. Now, when we go into that, in fact, the two key things I actually did want to ask you is, number one, and you kind of touched on this, you do have interest in working in professional wrestling. And I mean, is that something you're planning on acting on now, or something that you have in the back of your mind that someday you would want to act on? And the other thing is as far as the lawsuit situation goes, obviously everything was settled with Anthem and TNA, but not necessarily every individual involved in this scenario, so to speak.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, well, let's work backwards. I did settle everything involved with Anthem and the company that they bought, which is Impact Wrestling. What I did not do, and I fought for and maintained my right, is to sue the individual people that, in my estimation, did not accurately portray the business that was at hand. And that starts basically from day one. So whether or not I would pursue that case with those individuals is something I need to think about, because anytime you enter into litigation, it's quite messy. But I did not, and I refused to take that off the table. So that goes into what we're talking about, you know, if you're buying a car and it doesn't have an engine, you know what I mean? Somebody might want to mention that to you. As far as professional wrestling goes, I think there's a lot of interesting opportunities. I mean, you write about them all the time, Dave. I think the business is changing fast, and I think there will be some really interesting opportunities, like even today, where you have the announcement of the MMA union.
Right.
I think as individual talents, and I do think this is coming to wrestling quite soon, as individual talents realize that they have a lot more leverage and commercial opportunity in the marketplace, they may no longer look to a professional wrestling company as being their sole source of income or their primary source of income. They might actually see those companies is more their promotional side, and they might go make their money elsewhere. So I'm more interested in being in that business, and I think there's going to be incredible opportunities there. And whether that involves a promotion or not, I just don't want to fall to the same level of gravity, because as you've pointed out many times, without television, you cannot be a successful wrestling company. And right now, the traditional models that exist really aren't that attractive. Hence, you end up in a situation like TNA was in before Anthem purchased the company, where you're sort of scrambling to just keep moving.
That's actually my next question. So you funded a taping, and Great. Then another one, and then a third one, and then you pretty much made the statement that I'm not funding any more of these tapings, because if I do, we're just going to end up right back in the situation again.
Well, that's not totally true. That what I did say was I'm not going to repeat the mistakes of the past. So if I am going to fund and I am going to move forward, I'm taking this company over.
Okay. Okay.
And,
so
and trust me, that message was not well received.
I can imagine. So
well, that but they did make you president, at least as a public title, during all this.
Well, again, you get we're skipping around a little bit on the story, but you have to understand that by the time I put in money the third time, now I started to see the true picture that I was involved with, the personalities involved in where I had been, you know, lied to and misled. So, it's like a force majeure in chess. I mean, I was like, the only way I'm putting in money is if you're going to give me institutional control of this company, because it's being, in my estimation, mismanaged and taken in the wrong direction. And Talent was very, very receptive to that. And there was a real kind of cheer behind the scenes of like, okay, finally, we're going to kind of start doing things the right way around here, da-da-da-da-da. And what I quickly found out was, particularly from Dixie Carter, is as soon as I had that title in hand, she started working to undermine me and use her, you know, her various lieutenants to erode my power quite quickly and, you know, ignore directives or go around my back and do all sorts of weird, crazy things, which, again, may one day feed into a different form of litigation.
So,
well, I mean, the one thing, and actually this came up in court, was when they made you president, there's actually a memo that came out in court where I think she told Anthem that, oh, it's like a Jack Tunney title, so to speak, right?
Well, that's not what she told me. See, that
no. I mean, like, wasn't there like a memo that came out? I mean, yeah, like she told you you were president. She told you you were going to be in charge, and then you show up at the tapings, and all of a sudden, it's not exactly what you expected it to be. Is that pretty much what happened?
Well, it gets complicated, and there, like I said, there's certain things I can't talk about, but I'll say this much: when you inherit that position, and you don't have all the proper paperwork, and you agree to not have the proper paperwork to take over the position because everything's being done last second or the company's going to close its doors. There are conversations between lawyers where they're giving, various assertions on what it means. And I'll give you a perfect example. They sent through a flowchart, which was the TNA institutional flowchart, which we would use when we would go to pitch investors. And on that flowchart, there was a president at the top of the flowchart, and everybody was beneath the president. So they sent us that as proof of what I would be receiving in terms of power.
Now,
does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just finish. So when... Now I'm president in quotations. I start, making calls. I start dealing with the network. I start talking to various talents. I start making directives, and I start, telling people in the company what I'm looking forward to do. Suddenly, I realize that, now there's this other structure that's being put in place that has nothing to do with what's being asserted through attorneys. Nothing that's been negotiated. And it has everything to do with some one person's mad grasp to maintain power.
Now, I have to ask question.
So essentially, when you were doing this, when you were president, at the same time Dixie was trying to maintain her control of the company while telling you had control of the company.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so my question here is, when you funded the third taping and you made the statement that, if I'm going to do this, I need control of this company, did you know at that time exactly how bad off things were?
No.
Okay. So I guess the question is, in hindsight, are you glad that you did not get control of the company knowing what you know now?
Yes, I believe Anthem were the right party to take over the company. And even though I couldn't talk about it, I didn't. And even though people portrayed me as being, angry and bitter, I wasn't. My interest was the company continuing. I just wanted to deal with people at the table who were serious about continuing the company because, as I pointed out a few times, I mean, when you make detrimental decisions to a company like TNA was, and I say that in the past tense, you're affecting, kids and, aunts and uncles. I mean, you're affecting a lot of people. It's not just between you and some panda energy guy's daughter. You know what I'm saying? You're you're affecting a whole lot of people for a whole lot of different reasons. And as you've reported widely, there were lots of sort of issues involving, you know, pay and financing and stuff like that. So, you know, my intention was for the company to continue. And then when I found myself in a position where I didn't necessarily trust the actors that I was involved with, well, then I went for power, because that's the surest and safest way to maintain your money and your investment, and also protect people's jobs and stuff like that. So that being said, and to answer your question truthfully, knowing what I know now, knowing how it all worked out, I think Anthem was the right party to take over the company. You know, they're a well-funded company. They certainly seem to be serious and have honest intentions. They've dealt with me fairly. And you know, so that's that. It wasn't like I had to have control of the company if I didn't get control, and it was never like that for me at all. I mean, to me, it was a situation that unfolded, and part of the reason it unfolded the way it did is because I wasn't being given the facts that I deserved to have.
I just remember at the time when you had funded the third set of tapings, and it was abundantly clear that every time there was a taping, there was no money. And I was looking at the television deal, and I didn't know, I mean, none of us really knew what the real finances were of TNA, including you. And I remember at the time just thinking, why does Billy want this company? Was my main question. And I didn't know how bad off they were, but I presume they were very bad off. And it sounds like you had been led to believe they weren't that bad off, which is why you wanted the company.
I believe that starting a company from scratch is not only an expensive proposition, but it takes time to build an institutional culture.
Sure.
So having had my hands on the institutional culture, and now in my estimation having control, getting across a bridge that maybe I didn't think was as far as it turned out to be, that seemed to be doable. So it didn't, from the inside, it didn't seem as crazy as I know it looked on paper from the outside. Because as far as I was concerned, if I ended up getting the company, I was going to move the company in a very different direction. I was going to figure out a way to make it more, you know, to use the words of the lawsuit, solvent and satisfy the debts and sort of move on. I didn't realize there was a tax lien from the state of Tennessee. I mean, imagine, I'm quote unquote the president of the company. No one's telling me there's a tax lien.
It's an important detail.
Yeah, I mean that alone, just wipe out every other piece of information you know. You're the president of a company. You have people telling you, okay, you're now in charge, and people are willfully hiding the fact that the company's got a tax lien. I mean, that tells you the kind of cultural obstacle that I faced internally.
Now, you seem, as far as when this whole thing was going down with you suing and then Anthem putting in the money to save the company, essentially, and all that, at this point, you seem pretty happy in the sense that you got your money back, whatever the... I'm presuming that you're not allowed to say the exact amount, but you got your money back and you seem happy with how it all turned out. I mean, as far as with Anthem, you seem positive on Anthem itself running the company. What are your thoughts on, like, how... anything that they're looking at changing that you know of, or just a positive... You know, why you think that fortunes may be going for the better now?
Well, I can't speak creatively, and I don't know what they're going to do institutionally. But I do know that at least, you know, when you have the kind of funding and the opportunity that they have, then there's at least something solid there that the company can continue forward. It seems at least from the face of it that it's out of the helter-skelter portion. And let me say to my own detriment, I mean, even if I had taken over the company, even if my bids had been received and transferred, I would have found myself in a way deeper hole than I thought, you know, going in. And secondarily, it still would have been a bit of a magic trick to pull it off to get it to where it was solvent, progressive, moving forward, and, you know, people were going to get their checks on time and all that stuff. So, you know, good intentions, you know, don't always add up to sound business. And certainly I had a lot of people in my world questioning whether or not what I was trying to attempt to do was doable. And I said repeatedly in internal meetings involving these very issues to the various parties involved, I said, I just want whoever is going to make it happen, step up to make it happen. Where it got funky was how people read what I was due should it go a different direction, and that's where it got funky.
Now, you mentioned the institution that was TNA, and obviously that institution that was TNA had a... It was a tainted brand in the eyes of probably millions and millions of fans over the course of 12, 14 years. What were some of the ideas, if you don't mind talking about them, that you would have put into place had you taken over and it had not been the black hole that it was financially?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think it's easy to riff on the let's call it the dreamy part of, like, you know, the whole show would have been like the final deletion or something. I'm not saying that. I'm just sort of saying that like a joke. My first wave of concern, which was also brought up in the lawsuit and which was laughable, was that I wanted to move the company into a 21st century frame as far as its access to digital technologies and the opportunities that are available in terms of content and stuff like that. So I was doing a lot of work on the telephone using my contacts to build up rapport with people. And repeatedly, I would run into people in the entertainment world that would say, oh, I've dealt with TNA in 2006, or I dealt with TNA in 2009, or I dealt with Dixie Carter in this year. And repeatedly, they said to me over and over again, it was like a broken record, if you're running the company, we're willing to give the company another chance, and we like your ideas in this way, and we'd like to meet you in this kind of half-waist type stuff. In essence, you could sort of start to move the company in a modern direction. And over and over again, I heard, as long as she's not running things, we'll work with you. So I guess what I'm trying to say was my intention was more, could I make the company sort of work in the world that exists now in terms of television and content? And every contact I had, without exclusion, said, if you're running the company, we are interested.
Now, it is kind of interesting because you would have been buying a company that for 14 years had pretty much, even though they tried to rebrand it, I mean, everybody called it TNA. And over the years, I mean, many, many people have suggested you got to change the name, you got to change the name, you got to change the name. The name was what it had for 14 years. What were your thoughts on TNA, those letters?
Had to go. I said that from the day I walked through the door. The first time they interviewed me, I said, you got to change the name. And I was consistent with that, and that came from the top.
Now, as far as presentation of the product, I mean, it's what, like a catch-22. I mean, the best TVs that they did were the ones that they did at arenas, and they were also the most expensive, and that's the ones that got them into all the financial problems. I mean, how would you have, or what were your thoughts as far as that went? Because, I mean, I remember, like, when they did the shows from the UK, and you had the hot crowds, and even when they did it in Chicago and places like that, you know, you looked like, hey, this looks real major league, and the star, you know, the guys looked more like stars when you're performing in front of thousands of people. Sure. And you have the longer entrance ramp, you know, it made a world of difference. And then you went back to the Impact Zone, which of course is, obviously I understand why, but at the same time, I would watch those shows and go, like, now you're looking like the secondary brand again.
Right.
And so when you kind of like looked at that, I mean, what were your kind of thoughts on how you can present television where you can be major league, but also not lose your ass to being major league?
Well, I would start, and I'll try to keep it simple. My argument would be that you're not going to do better than WWE. And if you can't do better than WWE, you might as well just go in a different direction. And that is, you know, obviously commensurate with the way I've run my musical career. If you're not going to be a pop act and you're not going to be, the typical act that is successful, you have to find a different way to succeed in the marketplace. So my ideas were more based around production and presenting wrestling in a different way and shooting it in a different way that was less dependent on crowd. Because in my estimation, there was no metric in front of me, even when I was on the creative, that told me we were going to be able to run big crowds consistently anytime soon. So why not try to build a different brand with a different look, with a different feel, with a different rhythm, completely different from WWE? Because if you're going to succeed, that's the only way you're going to succeed. That seemed to me to be so simple, and it was a drum I beat from day one. And, you know, slowly but surely, I made some inroads on that. And, of course, when I was named president, I was really going to put the pedal down and go. And then, I, of course, when I pushed the pedal down, I realized that there were a lot of people there that were ignoring what I was saying.
Now, we're running low on time here, so I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about the future. David Lagana left the company pretty much immediately after it became apparent that you were going to be out of the picture. I guess your thoughts on David Lagana and what you plan on doing down the road.
Well, Dave, you know, really was one of the real MVPs of the company as far as changing the institutional culture, probably the best attractor for talent, and really, for lack of a better analogy, was probably the best psychologist in the company to keep talent there when they weren't getting their checks. And I mean, we had people threatening to not show up for pay-per-views. And I mean, there were lots and lots of issues that were born of circumstances that were beyond his control and mine. So to me, Dave was a real star in terms of really trying to bring the company forward. And so Dave and I are sort of working on together to try to figure out what we're going to do. But his leaving the company wasn't connected to mine. He had his own reasons, you know, I don't think he felt comfortable about where the company was going creatively. And I think when he saw the way I was treated, and he saw me as somebody who'd helped do good things for the company, I think he felt, well, you know, it was just a matter of time they were going to come for his head.
So basically, stay tuned.
I hope so. I mean, you know, look, you guys report constantly on what a crazy, strange business it is. And having been successful in another area of the entertainment business, I can say that, you know, there is no business that I've been in touch with that runs like the wrestling business. It really needs to be updated into the 21st century entertainment culture. I can't speak for WWE. I would assume they do run like a proper company. I mean, my experience in professional wrestling on the independent level and with what used to be TNA, and let's say the pre-Anthem TNA, you know, has been it runs on some weird, wacky non-gravity principle that doesn't have anything to do with reality. And when it does, that's when people start pointing fingers and calling you a predatory lender, you know, when you've saved the company three times in a row. And, you know, one day you're sitting at somebody's pool and they're telling you, thank you so much for what you do. And 3 weeks later, they're in court, you know, making you sound like you're the worst person that's ever crawled the planet.
Well, Billy, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. And if you've got any social media or anything that you would like to get out there, the floor is yours.
Oh, no, I'm good. I'm fine. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. I think, you know, like a lot of people, people grew weary of the subject. And, you know, hopefully this kind of closes the chapter on it. And whatever happens now is all good for everybody involved.
I looked at our traffic and people were not weary of this subject, but I'm sure you are. Well, thank you so much again today. And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll talk to you again after a while.